This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are men and women around you that have some stories to tell. And that is the case today. We're going to visit with 93-year-old Bob Austin of Oakhurst, California. He has some neighbors, some pretty secluded area out in the countryside. In fact, I ran across a deer and a fawn just on the curling drive over to Mr. Austin's house today. But it's a much different landscape than the one he grew up on. We're going to go all the way back to 1922 when he was born and hear about his childhood. But each week on this program, as you know, we visit with members of our greatest generation. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, preserve their stories so we don't forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, we learn a lot. And we're going to hear quite an adventurous story today of a pilot who had to crash land, who had to survive for a few months in hostile territory with some underground partisans in Eastern Europe. You're going to hear all about it before we're done. But let's start in those early days. Why don't you tell everybody where you grew up?
I grew up as a boy on Oahu, an Army post. I was an Army brat. I left Oahu July 31st, 1936, and went to Fort Lewis, Washington.
And so many veterans who I've interviewed, because I ask every veteran about December 7th, 1941, so many of them have told me, I didn't know where Pearl Harbor was. I'd never heard about it before. You were very familiar with Pearl Harbor, weren't you?
I was a mascot when I was a boy with a baseball team at Fort Shafter.
What does that mean, a mascot? You dressed up like something?
No, you're just like a bat boy for the baseball team, playing against the Navy or the Army from Schofield Barracks.
So you said you're an Army brat. Your stepfather was in the Army. And at that time, you know, I've heard a lot of folks who were there on December 7th. You weren't. You had moved off the islands by then. But what do you remember about that island culture before World War II started?
Had an awful lot of fun as a kid. We went swimming all the time, hiking, boar hunting.
Wild boar hunting on Oahu?
Up in the mountains.
By the time you left there, it's within 5 years of war coming to the islands. Did it ever occur to you that where you were living might be some kind of military target?
Oh, yeah. Fort Shafter was, I think they made it into a headquarters for the Army. It was above Pearl Harbor, up in the hills.
When you moved from Hawaii, which wasn't a state yet when you were there, you moved to Fort Lewis, Washington. And there was a pretty famous name who was stationed at Fort Lewis, Washington, who you got to know fairly well. Tell us who that was.
Lieutenant Colonel Eisenhower was a lieutenant colonel in the 3rd Division at Fort Lewis. My stepdad worked with him and was on his staff. And so when Ike went to the Pentagon, he went with him.
So your stepdad was there. So Ike also had a son who was around there at those times. And John Eisenhower, Dwight Eisenhower's son, was a pretty good friend of yours?
I knew John very well because we went to high school on the same bus together.
What was your impression of this man who would become one of the most famous generals ever and then our president?
I liked him very much. My mother worked for him when he was president of the Officers Club.
Oh, so he was president of the Officers Club at Fort Lewis before he was president of the United States. I guess maybe you could have seen some of those leadership qualities, huh?
Well, he was a lieutenant colonel, and then they took him to the Pentagon, and he went right up the ladder real quick.
Well, tell me what those years were like for you. So you're a teenager here around all these military guys, some who are going to become pretty famous. What were you up to during that time?
Pretty much normal things around the base, newsboy, and hiking with the Boy Scouts. It was a good time to be at the base. It was a wonderful base, Fort Lewis.
And you decided to join the Army Air Corps right after you got done with high school. So this is before the Japanese had attacked Pearl Harbor. Where did that desire to fly come from? How old were you when you decided, you know what, flying would be pretty neat?
I wanted to fly ever since I was 7 years of age and saw the bombers going over to bomb the Kilauea lava flow.
Kilauea was erupting and there was a lot of lava coming out and they were dropping retardant or what?
Bombs to divert the flow.
So they were dropping bombs so the lava flows would not destroy cities?
Yeah, to try to divert it so it wouldn't cover the landscape.
I don't know if most people have ever heard of that before, that was a tactic.
They were called Keystone Bombers based at Wheeler Field, which is next door to Schofield.
So you're 7 years old and you see these giant planes going over and you say, yeah, that's what I want to do.
I always wanted to fly when I was a boy.
So how long did you wait to sign up once you finished high school?
After I graduated as an aviation mechanic, July 31st, 42, I went to Fort Lewis and took the written exams and the physical, and then I got signed up 15th August, 42.
So you had already gone to aviation mechanic school. Was that all with the aim of being a pilot someday, or were you thinking, oh, if I can just do this, that'll be neat too?
Well, I was thinking of working for an airline, which I did for a couple months later on, but that didn't last long.
So this aviation mechanic school, this is in Southern California?
Glendale, California.
And that's where you were on December 7th, 1941?
Right, I was in the boarding house.
What do you remember about that day? What happened? How'd you find out?
Well, all the fellas come running out of the building asking me where Pearl Harbor was. So I had to tell them because I had been there as a boy. So then the next day we went back to school, the Army was there with drawn bayonets and so forth.
Yeah, and I've heard, you know, I've talked to a lot of people who were in Southern California at the time, and life really changed. I mean, blackouts and block wardens, and there was a whole lot of suspicion and tension. How did you experience that?
There was a lot of so-called anti-aircraft search when the Japanese came and hit Santa Barbara, I believe it was. And I was up all night that night, and I was the only one that was wide awake. Everybody else was slept through it.
So what were you doing while you were up all night?
Just watching the searchlights, see if they were going to fire an anti-aircraft, which they didn't.
So all over the Southern California landscape, there are searchlights in the sky looking for Japanese planes because a sub had shelled Santa Barbara.
Right.
Were you a little scared?
Well, concerned.
And you already told us, after you completed that aviation mechanic school, you did sign up to become a pilot, and that's no easy feat. And it's not like you just say, hey, I want to be one, and they let you do it. You've got to pass a lot of tests and go through a lot of training, right?
Well, the written exam and physical. I didn't pass the physical first time around, so I had to go back. They told me to eat a lot of carrots, which I did, and went back and passed good.
So why'd they fail you on the physical the first time? Was it your eyes?
My eyes.
But the carrots did the trick.
Well, vitamin A, I guess.
Were there some challenges along the way with the training? Were there some parts that were tougher than others?
No, as a matter of fact, I breezed through most of the training because particularly in pre-flight, when they discussed the engines and propellers and all, I'd already been in the aviation mechanic school, so I helped the instructor.
You were the teacher's aide, huh?
Right.
So it was a breeze for you. So your dreams were coming true. Did you have an idea, though, of which kind of planes you wanted to fly?
Always wanted to be a fighter pilot, but didn't make it. I don't know why. They never tell you.
What did it feel like the first time you got up in the air and you were at the controls?
Oh, I loved it. Boy, it was a wonderful thing to be up there all alone by yourself.
What kind of plane was that in?
Primary flying was a Fairchild single-wing monoplane. Then the BT-13 was the basic trainer, which I loved flying that at night. And then the advanced flying school, it was twin engine. I graduated as a pilot May 23rd, 1944. Now we went from there to Tucson, Arizona for overseas training in B-24s. And then from there we went to Lincoln, Nebraska to crew up. Just a while later, we went to Topeka, Kansas, and then we went overseas.
Did you fly over?
No, we lost our aircraft because they told us they had so many planes, not enough planes for the number of crews, so we lost our chance to fly over. So we went over by ship, 22 days on the water, zigzagging my submarines.
Your first impression of the B-24, the first time you flew it?
First time I flew it, I just loved it. Particularly the power, had 1,200 horsepower each engine, plus supercharge. I'm one of the very few pilots that ever tried to loop one. I got up to the top and fell out.
Well, I was going to ask you about that. Your son Randy, who let me know about you, said that somewhere you tried to loop a B-24 at 17,000 feet, and he figured you just stalled out and were hammering toward the ground. Tell me about that. Whose idea was that?
It was my idea.
What were you thinking?
I just thought I was curious if it could be done. If the CEO had known that, I'd have been court-martialed.
Did you have your whole 10-man crew on the plane at the time?
Yes.
What did they say about it?
There was a complaint because one of them hit the bulkhead on his head. He didn't like that very much.
Did you tell them that this was what you were going
to
do?
I tried to tell them ahead of time so they would hang on. Anyway, rattled around a bit.
So where were you?
In southern Italy.
Oh, this is actually overseas you did that. All right. Well, let's come back to that in a little bit. So you head overseas, and your base was in Italy. just south of Foggia. What was the name of that city?
Cerignola. 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 About 22 miles south of Foggia, which is a bigger city.
And when did you get over there?
Middle of October, 44. We landed at Naples on the ship the day that Wendell Willkie died. He was a Republican candidate against Roosevelt.
Did you have any idea what you were getting into?
I had no idea at the time.
And what about your crew? Were these, did you have the same guys you trained with in the States?
Yes, we all trained together at Davis-Monthan Field, Tucson, Arizona.
So you must have been a pretty tight crew by the time you got to Italy.
Yeah, a couple of them I didn't get along with. Didn't get along with the navigator or the bombardier, but the rest of the fellows were really wonderful.
And you were the co-pilot?
As co-pilot went over, and then we traded off. I have about as much first pilot time as he does.
And you flew all your missions with that same crew?
Same crew.
What was your first mission? What do you remember about that?
Linz, Austria. It was commercial. One big target that we hit was the Focke-Wulf fighter factory, Munich, Germany. We got the presidential unit citation for destroying it. And you wore a little blue thing on the right side of your coat.
Yeah, the presidential unit citation. So that happened pretty early on after you were there. What do you remember about that mission?
Kind of a routine.
Well, routine for you, but not for all the people listening. So I imagine your day starts pretty early?
Day starts, you take off about 7:15 in the morning.
You've been briefed before that?
Yes. You always have a briefing before you go out to the flight line.
They show you an aerial photograph of the target or what?
That's right. Complete details.
So then you take off, and how many planes are up there with you?
Quite a few. Our last mission in Czechoslovakia, 700 planes, 7,000 men.
That's insane. That's for people to imagine that. But those are just the American planes. Enemy planes are up there too. And that was my question of the missions that you flew. How frequently would you encounter enemy aircraft and or ground fire, the flak?
Seldom, because the black pilots from the Tuskegee Institute had B-51s along the Adriatic Sea coast. So they flew above us back and forth, protecting the bombers. They never lost a bomber the whole war.
So you had escorts on all your missions?
Not all of them, but most of them.
What did that mean to you to see those P-51s or those red tails up there?
It felt pretty secure.
Were you conscious of the fact that the Air Force, well, the Army Air Corps, was segregated at the time?
We didn't realize that until Truman made the decision to integrate.
So it had never occurred to you? You didn't think of them as any different than you guys?
No, no different. I wish I could have met some.
Well, I know a couple. Maybe we can connect you. So you're flying these bombing missions. Not a lot of fighter contact, but how about the ACAC? How about the guns from the ground?
The ACAC was not as accurate as I thought it would be. It was 88 millimeter. They could use them on land or air. In fact, that's what their tanks had, 88 millimeter.
And if you're in formation and that anti-aircraft fire is coming up, there's not much you can do to dodge it, right?
No, you have to fly straight according to the plan.
Fly straight through it, even if it's bursting right in front of you.
That's right.
You've already alluded to your last mission, but did you have some close calls before your last mission?
I don't recall any.
You don't sound like you were that concerned about your own safety over there.
Oh, I was concerned, but I was pretty busy handling the plane and making sure that we're in the proper formation.
Was that difficult, as tight as they had you guys stacked up?
Commanding officer said you either have a good bomb pattern or you're relieved the next day.
No pressure. Do you remember seeing or hearing about other planes from your squadron going down?
One in front of us, wait a minute, was back of us. It was number 4. It was right in back of us. But we saw it in the rear, you know. Got a direct hit in the bomb bay. They fortunately bailed out and got into Switzerland. In fact, I know who it was. It was Lieutenant Cassa and his crew.
But you saw that happen? You saw them get hit?
It makes a strange feeling when you see a plane hit right in front of you.
So you look back and you see this plane going down, and doesn't that tell you, hey, I could be next?
It's always that kind of scare, yeah.
Is that something you got used to over time, or was that always tough to deal with?
It was always kind of a strange feeling to see something like that happen. Of course, you know it does, particularly the 8th Air Force. They had a lot more than we did. B-17s were going down right and left. There was only a couple of squadrons of B-17s in the 15th Air Force where we were, mostly B-24s. Did you know that the B-24 was the largest number of planes built? 50,000.
And they built them in a hurry, too.
Willow Run, San Diego, Fort Worth, 50,000.
Yeah, that's a big number. And we still want to hear about the one that you had to land in a muddy Yugoslavian field 70 years ago. But for now, we need to catch our first commercial break. Go to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page for photos of Mr. Austin now and during World War II. And keep it here because Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Remember when the bank gave you free checking and savings accounts, even making money for you when you kept your dollars there? Paul Leffler here to say, I've recaptured those days, and you can too with EECU. It's not a bank, it's a nonprofit credit union that just keeps growing and growing. The newest branch is in Tulare, and nearly a quarter million EECU members represent 10 different California counties. As little as $250 in a savings account earns you dividends. And access is so easy. 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And I haven't even told you what I love most about EECU, the credit union's support of causes up and down our area, like Central Valley Honor Flight. Close to 500 World War II veterans have gotten to see their memorial in Washington, D.C. for free because of the leadership and financial support of EECU. Ready to join the team yet? Call 1-800-538-3328.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, visiting today with 93-year-old Bob Austin of Oakhurst, California. He's lived there since 1988, but he's originally from Hawaii. He spent some of his formative years in the state of Washington, and during World War II, he was flying missions as a B-24 pilot with the 459th Bomb Group, the 757th Squadron, out of Cerignola, Italy. His last mission ended with a crash landing in a muddy Yugoslavian field, and it would be nearly 3 months before he was evacuated. We're going to get to all of that, but before I forget, let's go back to this trying to loop the plane. So you're over there in Italy, you're flying combat missions, but you decide you're going to try to loop this B-24, and explain to everyone listening what that means when you say looping a plane. This is something fighter pilots would do, but not usually a bomber. So explain to us what the idea is and how it actually turned out.
Well, you go up to about 15,000 feet and put it in a dive and then pull out. As you get to the top of the loop, it loses lift, so you spin out. I lost about 6,000 feet.
Did your engine stall out on you?
No, they didn't, fortunately.
But what did that feel like?
Pretty much normal, because you have a belt on and so forth, you're strapped in.
Were you at all thinking this might end badly?
I was concerned whether there would be catches or not, and get hollered in by the commanding officer.
What would have happened to you if they did?
Well, they might have set us down either court-martial or some other punishment, because it wasn't usual. You don't do those things normally.
Yeah, so you could have been grounded for a while.
Right, I'll be grounded.
Are you still glad you tried it?
I never regretted it.
Have you ever met another B-24 pilot who took his in a loop?
Never found one that did.
Maybe you'll hear from one after this program. Well, if that loop wasn't excitement enough, you certainly endured a roller coaster ride from the start of your last mission to your repatriation, I guess. Tell me about that, December 2nd, 1944. What was your target supposed to be?
The target was Odertal Oil Refinery, which is about 800 miles from where we were. That's a five-hour trip at 160 miles an hour. I don't recall what the exact route was, but we went up the Adriatic Sea beyond northern Italy into Austria and then through Austria into Czechoslovakia.
You bombed the oil refinery, so you've completed the mission, you've dropped your bombs, you're heading home, and what happened?
The engineer said that we were running out of fuel and we had to do something, land or crash or whatever. So I radioed the commanding officer, and he said, well, we will send a P-38 to see you down. Never saw him again. I had to go through those clouds.
You said you're running out of fuel. There was a reason for that, right?
I think it was because we had used too much going up to the target.
So because it was really pushing the limits of your range on the way back, you're running out of fuel. And the weather was pretty gray. You couldn't really see where you were, huh?
Clouds were about 2,000 feet thick all over Europe. So we had to go through the clouds. That was kind of a scary feeling when you go through the clouds. You know, you're in a fog. You're in a fog. So then all of a sudden this huge hole opened up, and I'm sure that our Lord was with us then.
All of a sudden, a hole in the clouds.
Yeah, I just decided to dump the plane. Down we went, and we hit the mud. The mud was about 2 or 3 feet thick, and it slowed the plane down real quick.
What do you think your altitude was when you came out of the clouds?
No idea what it was.
But you were pretty low, and all of a sudden, you get through the clouds. You know that you're somewhere near a runway?
I knew they were just very short distance to the ground, you know, a couple thousand feet maybe.
But did you know from your navigator that you guys were in the vicinity of an airbase or no?
Navigator didn't know where we were.
So you're literally flying blind, right. Literally and figuratively flying blind.
Navigator didn't help us at all.
So all of a sudden, as you said, God was with you. This hole opens up in the clouds. You dump down through it. And how did you figure out where to go?
I just gave it full throttle to get the plane to go in near the trees so we could have trees hide the plane, which we did later on. We had the partisans cut some of the trees and lay up against the ship to try to hide it. The Germans came almost every day, tried to bomb it. They never hit it.
Okay, so I just want everyone to understand this. So your navigator didn't know where you were, but did you have an idea that you were over enemy-held territory?
Pretty much so. That's why we didn't bail out. We thought sure that the Wehrmacht, which is the Nazi army, was on the ground somewhere.
What you find out once you hit the ground is that you're in Croatia. Zagreb was maybe 20 miles away, but you said you came into the mud. So was there a runway there that you tried to land on? This is just an open, muddy field.
It was a cornfield. That's all it was, a muddy cornfield.
But you saw it and said, that looks like a good spot?
I didn't have much choice. When we had to go, we had to go.
Because the fuel was so low.
We had to crank down the gear, too, because I think the German aircraft must have hit our hydraulic. We had to hand crank the gear down.
So you had been shot up by a German aircraft on this one?
I think they just barely hit it somewhere. They didn't hit the propeller system, because that's also hydraulic.
So again, I'm just trying to understand this. So the hole opens up in the clouds. You guys come through it. You're running out of fuel. You tell the crew, crank down the landing gear because the hydraulics had been shot out. So this is kind of a chaotic scene, it sounds like. What was going through your head?
All we wanted to do was get down. And fortunately, it was pretty close diving down through that hole that was made for us. I'm sure it was purposely made for us to go through it. I'll always be thankful for that.
What do you think would have happened if that hole didn't open up?
We might have gone on further distance, maybe crashed into trees or something. We probably would have run out of fuel eventually. I don't remember how much fuel was left. It wasn't very much.
So you head into this cornfield. How forceful was that landing? What did it feel like when you hit?
It was kind of soft because of the mud. Mud was so thick. Mud must have been 2 or 3 feet thick. I remember it just splashed all over the wing of the plane when we hit the ground. And then the partisans put us into two homes, 5 of us in each home. The partisans gave us a little bit of meat once a week. Most of the time it was barley soup. I got sick and tired of barley soup.
Well, and you said before the partisans hid you out, was it a British officer who saw you and came out and yelled at you?
Well, they had a major and a captain and 2 lance corporals from England. He was Scots, as I remember, the major. And they did the coordination with Italy on the physical drops with the Lancaster bombers and the B-24s. They dropped all these huge canisters at night, boots, coats, machine guns, landmines, the whole works. Mm-hmm. And then you wake up the next morning and you see beautiful parachutes all over the place, orange, red, green, all over the landscape. They had bonfires so the planes could come in, see the bonfires, and drop that stuff. So we watched them at night.
So this was territory in then what was Yugoslavia that's being fought over at that time. It was up for grabs. It wasn't necessarily Nazi-controlled.
The only part that was Nazi-controlled were the railroads. The land was pretty much inaccessible because of the nature of the ground, like I said, so much mud. In the wintertime, they had the oxen tow these carts. But when it was warmer weather, it was just mud.
I think you may have just hinted at it, but explain to everyone why you couldn't just pick up and leave and go back to your base.
No way out.
The way would be to get on a train and the Nazis controlled those.
The Nazis controlled the railroad lines clear down into Greece. Albania and Greece. So there was no trains. We knew that eventually we'd get out. It was 88 days later, December 2nd, 44, to 1st of March, 45. They came in with C-47 aircraft, two of them. By then, we had about 75 people that had escaped from prisons. And so they all lifted us out to Bari, Italy, headquarters.
But that's an awful long 88 days, I'm sure. And again, just to educate people, because you lived through this, but most people are saying, boy, I've never really even heard of this. But maybe they've heard of Marshal Tito and the Yugoslavian resistance. And that's who these partisans are on the side of. So here, and all your crew survived? No injuries?
Yeah, everybody survived. The only one that got injured later was one of the gunners. He got injured in the leg. And the nose gunner died of urinary infection.
While you were over there?
No, after we came back.
But you all survived this crash landing, and you all survived the captivity. Something tells me your crew probably was thankful that you brought it down the way you did.
I never got much of a thanks for bringing it in. I guess it was just understood.
But you were at the controls?
Yes, I was. The other fellow was actually the pilot, right. But we traded off. I have almost as much first pilot time as he does, or did.
But, I mean, I'm just thinking, the margin for error was probably pretty slim. I mean, if you come down a little later or at a different angle or a little different way, you guys all could have died.
We probably could have crashed, maybe got killed, yeah.
But you don't. You survive, and then you have these partisans who are watching out for you, making sure the Nazis don't get a hold of you so you don't get sent to a prison camp. But you don't know when you're going to get out of there. So what were those 3 months like?
We foraged for food a lot because it was very scarce. We managed to go to an adjoining village where the man had lived in the USA. And he came back to Yugoslavia and set up a market. And so we helped him pitch hay into a loft. And he gave us a real nice dinner that was very infrequent, though. That didn't happen very often.
How did you spend most of your days?
Most of the days helping the people in the neighborhood cut firewood, help them around the place. Oh, gosh, I'm trying to think of all the things that we did. We did a lot of help for the home. Oh, we took our parachutes. We let them cut it up for making clothes for the children. In fact, they made me a pair of pajamas. I still have it.
You still have your parachute pajamas?
Yeah.
You don't have to show me right now, but I'll put a picture up at hometownheroesradio.com so everyone can see your parachute pajamas sewn in Yugoslavia during World War II. What about your family? Did they have any clue what had happened to you?
The major that was in charge of the British group radioed the 15th Air Force telling who we were, where we belonged, and that was radioed back to the States.
So your mother probably got a telegram or something that said you were missing in action?
Department, yeah.
But she had no way of getting mail to you?
No way.
And you had no way of getting mail to her?
No.
That had to be an awfully lonely feeling.
It was pretty lonely at times when you start thinking about home. We always wanted to go home, of course.
Did you ever ponder or question whether your side was going to win the war?
We were pretty sure we'd win it because the bombers were really pounding them. I mean, can you imagine the cities like up north, northern Germany? Oh, gosh, it was awful. Schweinhurst was one of them. Oh, those cities were really pounded. Unfortunately, a lot of civilians died.
And you guys would hear reports of this because of radio contact or what?
Once in a while, somebody found a copy and gave it to the British, who gave it to us, of the Army Times. And they had all the history of what's happening in the war.
You mentioned earlier there are a couple of guys on the crew that you didn't get along with. But for those 3 months, how much did you and your crewmates rely on each other to keep your spirits up, to keep hope alive?
Well, we did kind of a joke around. We had one deck of playing cards we wore off the face off of it, just playing during the day. Nothing else to do other than help the people around the house, cut firewood, clean the place, whatever. Oh, Christmas time, December 44, they slaughtered their own sow and made blood sausage. The first time I ever ate blood sausage.
How was it?
It wasn't bad. It was food.
Maybe you can tell us that. The connection you had that this family with this family that was keeping you. And
the village carpenter. And they had two children, a boy and a girl. I remember the day I left, I gave him my Boy Scout knife. I didn't have much else to give.
Did they speak English?
No. The lady of the house had a sister that came down from Belgium, and my navigator spoke perfect German. So they corresponded that way through the family. I guess we were lucky in that respect.
Do you know if that boy and that girl are still alive?
Have no idea. They'd be in their 70s or 80s. The girl was older than the boy. The boy was about 9, so that would make him about 79, if they're living.
Do you remember the family's name?
Sever, S-E-V-E-R, Sever, Alois and Maria. The boy was about 9. I think the girl was about 11. They made clothes for them out of the parachutes. We donated the parachutes because we knew we would never use them again.
If they were still alive, maybe they are. If they were sitting right where I'm sitting right now, what would you say to them?
It'd be hard to recollect anything that would be meaningful. Don't speak the same language.
I guess maybe the better question is their hospitality, their generosity, their sacrifice, and the risks that they took on your behalf. What does that mean to you?
Generous, very generous. And we tried to do as much in return by helping out. Yeah, it was quite an experience.
And it's the kind of experience few have ever heard about, partly because the rescue and evacuation of Allied airmen from then Yugoslavia was shrouded in secrecy for quite a while. We'll illuminate a little more history and get the rest of Bob Austin's World War II story in a moment after we hear about a program that Bob is scheduled to be a part of this month when the 8th Central Valley Honor Flight takes off from the former Castle Air Force Base in Atwater, California on October 19th. If you're anywhere in the area, you can go welcome Bob home from his trip on October 21st. Put that on your calendar. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive, and then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that honor flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses going to your heart, you just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. It gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.
This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and a fascinating conversation with World War II bomber pilot Bob Austin, who was born on Oahu 93 years ago. He's called Oakhurst, California home for the better part of 30 years. If you're a ham radio enthusiast, perhaps you know him by his call sign, Kilo Charlie 6 Echo Zulu Echo. Yep, he's still at it, and he also happens to be one of just a few thousand American airmen who were airlifted out of Croatia by a secretive program called the ACRU, Air Crew Rescue Unit of the 15th Air Force. It began in late 1944 as the brainchild of the OSS, the predecessor of the CIA. It had to stay under wraps so as not to compromise the identities of Yugoslavian partisans who were helping the Allies. In addition to evacuating Allied airmen, like the 500 who were lifted out in the famous Operation Halyard, the ACRU program also featured night flights dropping supplies of every different kind to the partisans to aid their fight in driving the Axis forces out of Yugoslavia. We've heard about how Mr. Austin, in control of a B-24 that was dangerously low on fuel, saw a break in the clouds and took the bomber down into a muddy cornfield on December 2, 1944. It would be 88 days until his rescue came on March 1st, 1945. So 88 days. How much did you weigh when you crash landed?
I was probably about 165, and I went down to about 140 before we left. Because the food was not very much protein, or no green vegetables, no tomatoes, no corn, nothing like that. It was just a sort of a soup-like stuff from barley, yeah, barley soup, most of the time.
Were you aware at the time, did they tell you how your rescue came about? Do you know anything about that?
I don't know what caused them to send the airplanes in. They sent two planes in to pick us up. Because by then we had about 75 guys that had escaped from prisons up in Maribor, on the border of Yugoslavia and Austria. Maribor prison. They had several people that escaped. They hiked at night and hid in caves during the day and came down to where we were. I don't know how they found us.
But somehow they got the word to an American airbase, and they sent two C-47s to pick y'all up.
I think the C-47s were South African pilots. I don't know where they came from.
So is this something you knew was going to happen in advance, or was this the best surprise?
A surprise.
So tell me about that. What happened that day? This was
the major in charge of the British group radioed to 15th Air Force that we were ready to be picked up if possible. So they made arrangements because the weather changed. The weather got better in March, and set these planes in. And they took us out, no parachutes on the board of the ship, so that was scary, yeah. Flying across the Adriatic without parachutes, and then landing at Bari, Italy. Then they sent us back by truck to our own base. Hard to believe it was 70 years ago.
Yeah, and hard to imagine for the rest of us what that must feel like, because I'm sure there had to be days during those 3 months where you wondered if you were ever going to get back to America again, ever going to see your family again.
Yeah, it was always a question in your mind, what was going to happen, how we were going to get back, if we got back.
Have you ever thought about what would have happened if those C-47s didn't come, if you had to wait there a couple more months until Germany surrendered?
That would have been quite a wait. That would have been almost 2 months, because it was May 8th of 45, the Germans surrendered. Yeah, it was a strange experience. I don't think I've ever talked about it before.
Really?
I'm sure of it. I've never talked about it.
Well, I'm sure it's got to be hard looking back to remember those emotions that you felt, but can you put that into words, what that moment felt like to land back in Italy and know that this nightmare was over?
Well, it sure was a good feeling. They sent us to hospitals for 3 or 4 days to fatten us up. Then they were still using DDT, so we had to put DDT in our hair to kill the lice, because the lice were all over our bodies. We slept on straw. Didn't have the foresight to make hammocks. I don't know why, but we never thought of it. We should have. Somebody should have.
Was there a thought or a focal point or maybe faith that helped you keep believing you were going to get out of that during those tough days?
Yeah, I'm surprised that we did have a pretty strong faith, particularly when the huge hole opened up in the clouds. I knew that somebody was watching out for us.
But then almost 3 months later, when you're still stuck in Yugoslavia and you're starving and losing all this weight and you're miserable, where does the faith or the hope come from then?
Oh, I think just the camaraderie between us. You know, he's talking about home and our hometowns. I learned a lot about the hometowns of the other fellows. We had one from Illinois, one from Kentucky, two from Ohio, two from Texas, one from Mississippi.
Have you ever gotten together with any of those guys since the war?
I tried to find Bill Montgomery from Kentucky, but I haven't been able to locate him. I think a good number of them might be deceased. The navigator, Erwin Keebler, he spoke perfect German, lived in a German area in Ohio, I guess. George Davis was from Garland, Texas. He was a short little fellow. I don't know why they ever made a bomber pilot out of him. He could hardly reach the pedals.
Well, tell me about the moment, because this is always fascinating to me. Guys who have had to live in the absence of freedom or in that uncertainty of not knowing if you're ever going to get back again. It always seems like a pretty memorable moment when they taste freedom again or when they see their family again. Do you remember when you first saw your family or spoke to them?
I didn't see my family till quite late in 1946. Yeah, we discharged. Yes, I had, yeah. And then we drove all the way to Los Angeles, November 46. So it was quite a bit later.
Had you spoken to your mother on the phone or anything?
Yes, I had, yeah.
Did she give you any taste of what that had been like for her, not knowing what happened to you?
Yeah, they all felt kind of left out of it because there was a big gap in communications, a real big gap. So they had to rely on the War Department letters and so forth. General Eisenhower's aide was a very personal friend of mine. I knew him well when he was a master sergeant. I knew him from Fort Lewis. Gosh, it seemed like yesterday, you know.
Was it emotional to see your family again?
Well, I'll say it was, yeah. So much so. 1941, I first met my real dad, February 1941. On my way back to Tacoma to graduate from high school. That's the first time I ever met him. That was strange, meeting my dad for the first time.
So did you see him after the war again then, too?
Yes, oh yeah. Kept in touch. He was from southern Georgia. Well, he went from the Army into Coast Guard down at Long Beach, came back from Alaska, and went across the street and signed up for the Coast Guard. Then he retired, Lieutenant Commander, as a finance officer. He was on all board those landing ships in the South Pacific, all the ones into those islands, Guadalcanal, Tarawa, so forth.
You both had some stories to share after the war then. So you came back, went to L.A. City College, met a beautiful young lady named Sylvia. You're still married 67 years later, three children, now your grandpa. Have you ever stopped and thought, boy, if that last mission went a little different or the 3 months that followed went a little different, none of those people would be here?
That's right. It never would have happened. Yeah, well, I've had a beautiful family, three children, two boys and a girl. Yeah. Sylvia's my life. She made my life. Without her, it was nothing. A lot of people don't believe me, but we never had a serious, drag-down argument. Never had any hate or anything of that sort.
What's your secret?
Just love and be loved, yeah. I love Sylvia more than I love life.
You talked about the different guys on your crew and how they were from different parts of the country. And especially with that time you had in Yugoslavia where you're not flying and you guys are around each other all the time, I'm sure you developed a pretty strong impression. What do you think those of us who weren't alive then need to know now about the kind of men and women who were serving our country at that time?
Well, I think most people were pretty dedicated to the war effort, and other things were set aside. I think the camaraderie that we had helped us through it. Like, it had a lot to do with it, the camaraderie.
Was it because you all believed in what you were doing or what the goal was?
Right. It's an important thing to win the war.
Did you understand at the time the magnitude of the threat that Nazi Germany posed? I mean, did you understand how severe that was?
Didn't understand an awful lot of it. In fact, we weren't told about the concentration camps that the Jewish were persecuted. We didn't know anything about that. I don't know why.
Knowing about it now, I imagine it gives you some pride to know that you had a hand in defeating that regime.
Oh, yeah. The Nazis were the world's worst. They lost a lot of Germans in World War II. The Russians did, too. Do you know how many we lost?
400,000.
406,000.
I more than 60 million worldwide died during that time period. You mentioned that number, 406,000. If you end up going on this Central Valley Honor Flight to Washington, D.C., you'll see the National World War II Memorial and gold stars representing that number. Were any of those people you knew? Did you lose any friends during the war?
Yes, I did. I lost some pilot friends. Well, most of those that the United States lost are buried in France and Belgium and Germany. That's a lot of people. Vietnam was about 62,000. Korea was about 55,000. I don't know about Grenada and some of these others.
But you know those numbers, and I have a feeling that that means something to you. The names behind those numbers. How do you feel about those who gave their lives during World War II while you were serving?
I often think about them and the courage that they exemplified. There was a lot of camaraderie between the troops.
What would you say with regard to your service in the Army Air Corps? What were you most proud of?
Hard to say other than the fact that we got some of those decorations, particularly the Presidential Unit Citation for the factory in Munich.
And you said the plane, the B-24, that you crash-landed in Yugoslavia in that muddy cornfield, that the partisans helped you hide it in a grove of trees?
They cut the trees and then laid them up against the ship. I've got the pictures here somewhere, but I have to look for them.
All right, we'll hunt those down. We'll post those online at hometownheroesradio.com. But so they hide the plane there, and you said the Germans tried to bomb it a few times?
They tried to bomb it. They were very precise. They came over exactly noon and tried to bomb it. They never hit it. There's all kinds of bomb craters. I have pictures of those bomb craters.
Were you ever a little too close for comfort with one of those bombs?
No, it's quite a ways away.
You think that plane's still there?
I have a feeling they must have burned it. Probably somebody opened the petcocks and the wings and let what little gas was left probably burned it.
While you were there, or you mean you're just guessing since?
Later. I think it was later somebody burned it. I know it never flew out of there. That was a good ship. Oh, I loved it.
Did it have any nose art or a special name or anything?
We had a red heart on the nose. Yeah, the squadron had a red heart. But we didn't put any name on it. We didn't put any name on it like some of them did. Particularly the people like the ones that had Betty Grable on their ship. Sure. We didn't have anything like that.
Well, before I forget, I just want to say thank you for serving our country. Thank you for telling us a little bit about it. Is there anything else you think we need to know?
Can't think of anything, Paul. I'm surprised that I remember dates like I did. I can remember back to 4 years of age on dates. For some reason or other, the brain must have it.
God gave you a good one. What would you say that you're most thankful for?
As far as the war, I think the camaraderie that we had, caring for each other. But then, of course, the family was eventually more valuable.
And they'll be happy, but I'm sure not surprised to hear that. Bob Austin, 93 years old. What a unique story he has. Check out the photos then and now on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. Or better yet, greet Bob and about 70 other World War II veterans when they return from their honor flight to Washington, D.C. That'll be the evening of October 21st at the former Castle Air Force Base in Atwater, California. We're out of time on this edition of Hometown Heroes. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.